Matthew chapter 2, let's check it out. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, after the tribe of Judah, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem. Who were these fellas? We're going to go all the way back to the year 606 BC. The great Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, has rolled through the land. He defeated Pharaoh Necho at the Battle of Carchemish, and on his way down and pursuing the remnant of that army, he stops in or near Jerusalem, lays siege to Jerusalem, and conquers the city. Just like the prophet Jeremiah prophesied that Nebuchadnezzar would do. So the best and the brightest of Israel is picked up and moved back to Babylon. Babylon is not far from the modern city of Baghdad, there on the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. So 606 BC, Israel loses its national sovereignty. But then Nebuchadnezzar allows a remnant to remain there in Israel and Jerusalem specifically. He sets up a vassal king, and then he got to listening to the false prophets of Israel saying, you should throw this Babylonian yoke off of you. Nebuchadnezzar has to come back again, lays siege one more time, defeats the city one more time, exports another group of people. That second exportation includes Ezekiel. They act up again. Nebuchadnezzar comes the third time and he says, that's it, I've had it with you. And he destroys Jerusalem and the temple. And one particular date on the Jewish calendar, the 9th of Av, and out they go now for the next 70 years. 70 years later, another king arises, a Persian king in Babylon, and he has taken over the Babylonian Empire, and his name is Cyrus the Great. He conquers the Babylonians, takes over the city of Babylon. Cyrus, on his triumphal entry, he's met there by a rickety old fella, perhaps in his 90s. Who is it? It's Daniel, the prophet Daniel that you hold in your lap. Daniel shows him an older book still, the book of Isaiah. And opens up to right around chapter 44 and 45, our chapter 44. And he says, check this out, King Cyrus. And then I'll paraphrase, thus says the Lord God Jehovah, I raised up a fella by the name of Cyrus. Spelled out 150 years before King Cyrus was even born. And he goes, hey, my name's in your ancient scriptures. And Daniel's all, yep. What's it doing there? Because God knows all things, says Daniel. And so impressed is Cyrus that he says, your God really has got something going on. He then issues a decree, and most of Israel returns back to the land of Israel and tries to rebuild then the city and the nation itself. Well, a great big group of Jews don't ever leave. And one of them is Daniel. He stays right there in Babylon. He has been raised to something called a Raj, R-A-G, Magi. In the Babylonian understanding, they believe that dreams were a big part of how the cosmos would speak to people. The precision of the field of stars as they progressed across the night. The field of stars march across the sky and they don't change their position relative to one another except for five little wandering stars. Wandering stars in the Babylonian Persian eventually will become Latinized to planets. So as the stars marched across, you'd go out the next night, five of those little rascals would have moved against the other pinpoints of light. You'd go out and you'd look into the 12 constellations that marched across the sky, across the approximate pathway of the sun called the ecliptic, and every month of the year, they were in a different position, these 12 major constellations. You come out the first night, and there's Virgo rising in the east. You go out the next night, boop, and it was a little closer. and they called them Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Thank you, Mr. Gross, my sixth grade science teacher. Five of those would move across the sky, some slower than others, but here was the tricky part. They would march in a certain direction night after night after night, and then sometimes they would stop. And then you come out the next night and it starts to move in an opposite direction, stop again, and then start to continue its pathway on around. And people went, why do they do that? And Aristotle, I don't really know. Early history, mankind used to think that the earth was the center of the universe and that the whole universe revolved around the earth. You're going to have to wait until you get to Copernicus in the early 1500s. Mathematically, he proved that the earth was not the center of the universe, and he got greatly persecuted for his trouble. Then you're going to have to go to the early 1600s, a fellow by the name of Johannes Kepler. Kepler, using the Copernicus model and some more advanced math, he actually charted that these wandering stars were not stars at all, but they were planets. He was the one who figured it out. Here's why the stars march in a direction and then, boop, suddenly stop. What's called a retrograde. It moves backwards, stops again, and then continues. And he said, here's why. The sun is at the center of our solar system, and here's the earth moving around it. Stop and look at Mars, and it would appear a certain way. And then as it moves on around the sun 6 months later, Mars is still moving on its form, but relative to the platform of observation, Earth, it stops. So without getting too astrophysical on you, that's why the planets to us appear to move, stop in a retrograde, reverse their position, circle, and then continue on their march. Thank you, Johannes Kepler. And then in the late 1600s, Sir Isaac Newton. Truly one of the most brilliant minds God ever made. And in the math of his day, on pen and paper, Sir Isaac Newton, using Johannes Kepler's laws of planetary motion, he wrote a little something over the weekend called Laws of Motion and Universal Gravitation. Newton, through mathematics, nailed it down cold why gravity and how gravity, the bigger the planet or the star, the more gravity, the smaller, the less gravity. He also figured out how Earth pulls on Mars and Venus, and how the Sun pulls on all three, and how Jupiter and even the next star over, Alpha Centauri. He did that in the late 1600s. He realizes that the entire system, the universe, is sort of like the greatest clock ever invented. He literally was able to plot where the sun and the moon would be next year, or next month, or next decade, or a million years from now. Thanks to computers, now, instead of your own pen and paper and a huge head for math, you just go get yourself a program. My favorite is called Starry Night. You put it on your laptop or your iPad, and you go out to the stars at night, and you hold up your iPad or your laptop computer, and the geosynchronous satellites moving around the Earth, three of which triangulate your position on the planet, you just hold your smartphone, your iPad, your laptop up, the computer tells you where you are on the planet, and he tells you what planets and stars you're looking at. Does that just geek anybody else out? Or is that just... In the old days, before cable television, and before the Industrial Revolution that smoked up the planet, what did people do typically at night? Well, they knit, and they sewed, and they told stories. And if you're in or near this region of Jerusalem, especially in the temperate months and even the hot months, because there was no central air conditioning, they moved out of their hot little compartments. They moved up on the roof And that's where a lot of socializing and entertaining went on. And what do you suppose was always the show at night? The stars. And in those days, as a rule, most people knew the stars. They knew their names. And it was a pretty important pastime. And so people who really got this stuff down, they had to observe it night after night after night for years. That's a discipline right there. There was nobody better at that than the observers in Babylon. And a sect begins to arise, and this sect is sort of held in great esteem by the people for two reasons. They were hugely advanced in mathematics. They were able to predict where stars and planets would be in the near future, and predicting eclipses and solstices and all of that. And to the common people, ooh, that's pretty cool stuff. And they were called magi. The word that we're going to get our word magi straight. Magistrate. It means head of state. Remember, if you read the book of Daniel, God gives him the answer to Nebuchadnezzar's torturous dream. And in that culture, that was huge. You're awesome, says Nebuchadnezzar. And he raises Daniel, promotes him to the office of Rab Magi, or the chief of the Magi in Nebuchadnezzar's court. That customarily was a hereditary position, and that priesthood was disrupted, and they didn't like that this whippersnapper from Israel is getting the best gig in town. And they threw him in the lion's den. So skilled were many of these magi that even after they go down a couple hundred years later to the Romans themselves bring them into the fold of their leadership. It changes a little bit under their Latin influence, and they begin to move into more occultic spiritualisms, some pretty freaky stuff. And that began to creep into the culture as magi sciens. Magicians. Remember in Daniel chapter 9, Daniel says that he was praying, he realized the 70 years of captivity prophesied by Jeremiah are up. He asked the Lord, what's going to happen to Israel? Gabriel shows up to him and says, here's your answer. 70 weeks of years are going to happen, and it's going to start when there is a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. And it's going to be from that decree, 69 weeks of years. It'll start when there is a decree to rebuild Jerusalem specifically. It will end when Messiah is rejected. That's easy math. 445 BC, there it is in the history books. Now, if Daniel knew that was going to happen, would his intellectual successors know it too? I think that's reasonable. They knew that in 173,880 days, that a Messiah in Israel would be rejected. Well, a Messiah has to be born before he is rejected. Were they counting the days? Potentially. Back to 300 BC. Alexander the Great conquers the whole region. 166 BC, the Jews will throw off the last of her Greek overlords, the Maccabean Revolt. And then across the way, the Persians will also throw off their Greeks under the Persian party known as the Parthians. Roman general, a guy by the name of Pompey, he conquers Judea in 63 BC. But he tries to go against the Parthians and loses at the Battle of Carrhae in 55 BC. The Herod in the story, his father is a fellow by the name of Antipater, and he's a half a Jew. He's Idumean. He's from Edom. There's some reasons for that. But he jumps in and helps Mark Antony, Cleopatra, helps Mark Antony push the Parthians further east and establishes Roman rule in Judea. Rome is so grateful, he gives Antipater, the emperor does, governorship over the region. About 50 BC, Antipater appoints his son Herod in this story, ruler of Judea. 2 years later, Herod's new fresh paint on buildings of his capital there in Jerusalem are barely dry, and he is forced out by a resurgence of Jewish nationalism led by a fellow by the name of Antigonus. He is a full Jew, and the Hasmonean Empire is restored. And where does Herod go? He's got to run all the way back to Rome. He returns a couple years later with Roman legions, and Antigonus is defeated 40 BC. Herod is restored as king. And the Jews didn't like him very much. 38 years later, around 2 BC, Herod is in the last year of his miserable, and I mean miserable, life. Herod was eaten up with intestinal worms that when he died, they burst forth, and it was a bad deal. Come on, how many of you like gruesome history? Just a little bit. And also before he dies, he knew he was so hated. He knew that he was getting ready to die. He rounds up over 100 of Jerusalem's most popular Jewish leaders. He incarcerates them in a large cistern. He stipulates that when I pass away, no one's going to mourn my passing. So when I die, kill all of those Jewish people. Then Israel will mourn. He killed his wives. He killed his own people. It was said of Herod, it would be safer if you were one of Herod's pigs than being one of his relatives. When he dies, the last year of his miserable life, I'll quote Chuck Missler, "Emperor Augustus was also aged. And since the retirement of Tiberius, Rome was without any experienced military commander. Pro-Parthian from the east, pro-Parthian Armenia was gathering strength for a revolt against Rome, which they would successfully accomplish within 2 years. The time was ripe for another Parthian invasion of the buffer zone provinces, Judea. It was at this time that the Persian Magi, in their dual priestly governmental office, composed the upper house of the council of the magistanes, if you will, the magistrates, whose duties included the absolute choice and election of the king of their realm. It was these guys, Persian Parthian king makers, who entered Jerusalem the last year of the reign of Herod." That's good stuff, right? Okay, let's just dive right in. "In the days of Herod," you've been caught up to speed, "behold, Magi." They're from the east, likely from the Parthian Empire, likely even from Babylon itself. And it is my supposition, and the supposition of some, they are direct intellectual descendants of Daniel himself. More on that in just a moment. "Wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, 'Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?'" What do you think Herod might have said? I'm sorry, excuse me. "What? I thought I was king of the Jews." You think he might have had a problem with that? "For we have seen his" what, everybody? "His star in the east and have come to worship him." And when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all of Jerusalem with him. And with all this historical background, now you know why. "Oh no," said the people, "not another Roman Parthian war fought on Israel, please, no." Verse 4. "And when he had gathered all the chief priests and the scribes of the people together, he inquired of them where the Christ would be born." Remember, we read English translations of the original Greek here in the case of the New Testament. But even Herod the Great, a half-Jew, would likely not have said, "Where was the Christ?" He would have said, where is the Mashiach to be born? The Messiah. And they said to him, oh, easy one, king, in Bethlehem of Judea, for thus it is written by the prophet, and cites the Old Testament prophet of Micah, chapter 5, verse 2. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the rulers of Judah. What is Judah, you guys? The tribe of Judah. For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Now this cracks me up. These fellows, if they are from Babylon, how far away is that? That's about 700 miles. How long would it take magi, wise men of the upper echelon, and they're not going to travel alone, they're going to travel with a cavalry of some force with them, because after all, what are they carrying with them? Some pretty priceless gifts. This is a whole lot of people. How long would it take a huge caravan to go some 700 miles? If you do the math on a certain average per day travel, you're going to get roughly about 5-ish months. They've traveled for potentially 5 months, 700 miles, and the religious leaders of Israel live right there. Bethlehem is 5 miles to the south. A good fire on a dark night, you can see that far away. The religious leaders knew all about the signs. Yeah, that's an easy one, Herod. Bethlehem, Sisera, right there. Did any of these religious people even get out of their lazy boys to go there? Nah. Verse 7. Then Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, the magi, he determined from them what time the star had appeared. They could do some calculations. Verse 8. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the young child. Notice he doesn't say baby. I don't believe that it is the time of the actual birth of our Lord. We looked at that a couple weeks ago, which was probably the end of our month of September, and very potentially he could have been born on Rosh Hashanah. And when you have found him, bring word back to me that I may come and worship him also. Yeah, right. Right, verse 16, what does he do? He orders the death of all the boys, 2 years and younger. He wanted to kill him. Verse 9, and when they had heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star, which they had seen in the east, went before them, till it came and stood over, or if you will, stood still, where the young child was. Probably if you've got your manger scene, and there's Joseph, and then there's Mary, and then there's little baby Jesus in the manger, and there's cows. What is always a part of your manger scene? The three wise men, the three magi. They probably were not there that night specifically. There's some reasons for that I'll show you here in just a minute. By the way, it doesn't say three magi, does it? They're going to give three gifts. My supposition is there were more than three. Pretty soon, you get about the 15th century or so, and then some churches are actually naming these guys. Belteshazzar and, Larry Curly and Moe.